I guess one of the concerns that should be raised, or at least is, I think, present in many of our minds, is why are we so concerned about morality today? Is it different than it used to be in American society? And what's occurring in our society that causes us to devote more thinking about the changes that are taking place today as compared to, let's say, 50 years ago or so? There are two individuals who are involved in this plot, so to speak. One is Piaget, and the other is Lawrence Kohlberg. The whole issues related to moral development can be traced back into time, and I would like to read to you a section from one of the books I use in my educational psychology classes. This is a book by Sprintall and Sprintall, and they refer to a study done, a number of studies done by two individuals back in the late 20s and early 30s by the name of Hugh Hartshorne and Mark May. They're both at the University of Chicago at the time. This research has been found to hold true today, and it was very disturbing to these two individuals. And what they were focusing upon at the time was the so-called bag of virtues that existed and was believed to be carried out through proper teaching with young children. I'd like to read this section by way of introduction. In the literature of almost any school, character building can be found as a stated objective. The Boston Public Schools Curriculum Guide in Character Education proclaims that we are unfit for any trust till we can do and obey. Honor thy father and mother. True obedience is true liberty. First law ever God gave to man was a law of obedience. Each agency has its own list of virtues to be taught to pupils. Some endorse honesty, service to others, self-control. Others promote courage, responsibility, friendliness. Practically every man remembers the Boy Scout oath, or at least the last line, brave, clean, and reverent. Similarly, most women probably remember memorizing the Girl Scout oath or the Campfire Creed. The idea behind these rituals is quite simple: to instill in the young particular traits and virtues. Character building was thought to be the means of achieving discipline in the classroom as well as in life. In fact, it is truly amazing that this notion was accepted for centuries before someone finally examined how effective the process actually was. In the 1920s, two researchers, Hartshorne and May at the University of Chicago, conducted a long series of studies which they replicated again and again. Their results were a bombshell. In every study, they arrived at the same conclusion. Formal character instruction had no positive effect. They studied regular school classes in character education, special Sunday school classes, Boy Scout classes, and others. In every case, they conducted that there was no correlation at all, essentially a correlation coefficient of zero. Their studies involved character education, virtue training, and actual behavior, such as cheating. They also found essentially no consistent moral behavior in the same person from one situation to another based on character education. This seemed to imply that people who cheat in one situation may or may not cheat in the next situation. The sample honesty tests accompanying this discussion may demonstrate such an assertion. And there is in this textbook a test that can be used to pursue that matter. In general, moral behavior seemed unpredictable and moral character traits mythical. If ingrained traits such as honesty or dishonesty did exist, then it would be possible to predict behavior accurately. To make matters worse, Hartshorne and May were as dismayed as everyone else. The researchers also found no relationship between what people said about morality and the way these same people acted. People who express great disapproval of cheating or stealing actually steal and cheat as much as anyone else. Hartshorne and May concluded that it was meaningless to divide people into simple categories and label them as either honest or dishonest. Almost everyone is dishonest some of the time, and like so many other aspects of human nature, Cheating is normally distributed around a level of moderate cheating. A normal distribution means we can fit the results of tests that detect cheating on a bell-shaped curve. The distribution will look the same as that for measured intelligence, height, weight, and coin flipping. Hartshorn and May found that what was true for supposed traits such as honesty and dishonesty was also true for traits such as altruism, selfishness, and self-control impulsiveness. What this does, of course, is call into question the entire concept of character traits. What is true for Hartshorn and May's seemingly old-fashioned virtues is equally true for the virtues which we may cherish today. This means that if we ridicule the idea of teaching children to be thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, an antiquated bag of virtues, it is also meaningless to try to teach children to be spontaneous, open, authentic, or genuine. A bag of virtues is a bag of virtues. None is particularly amenable to being taught. Merely changing the content of the virtues to be taught will not change the outcome. We may prefer the more modern traits, but this does not advance the educational problems of students' growth and discipline. Well, that's from Sprintall and Sprintall, based upon Hartshorn and May's research. One of the earliest persons to begin to deal with moral growth and development was Piaget, and I think perhaps you might like to know something about Piaget. He is currently 83 years old. He is the foremost developmental psychologist in the world today. He is Swiss, and he lives in a part of the world in which being bilingual or multilingual is very common, yet he can speak only French. So all his work has to be translated from French into many different languages. And as you know, things get lost in translation. He is not the easiest person to understand, as you may get some indication by that yellow sheet. He is an absolutely brilliant person, highly productive at age 83, yet. He still gets up at 4 in the morning and writes sometimes 2 or 3 publishable pages before he teaches his classes at the Geneva Institute. He has quite an avid following of graduate students who tend to prove or disprove his theories, and he keeps cranking them out. He was a very precocious child. At age 10, he wrote a paper on the albino sparrow, which was accepted for publication. It took him 2 years to finish his undergraduate work at age 18, and he had a PhD by age 21, along with some 20-some articles published. He is not a psychologist by training. He is a zoologist. And at age 15, he was offered the curatorship of the Geneva Museum of Natural History. He's absolutely brilliant. I would very much like to meet him. He is a very grandfatherly, gentle type man. Just a fascinating person. Now, he got involved in this because he was interested in what young children do in terms of their reasoning processes, particularly when they gave wrong answers to what was acceptable to adults. When kids tend to do that, they give answers that we don't like to hear or they're incorrect, and somehow we don't react to them in a proper way. But he was curious about this, particularly when it was done in relation to intelligence tests. As a result, his own research led him to some conclusions about moral reasoning processes in young children. And this yellow sheet kind of serves as a summation here. In young children ages 6 through 12, there is a transition that takes place from what he calls heteronomy to what he calls autonomy. Heteronomy is viewing rules as being very sacred, and these rules are handed down by adults. And children conform to rules. They eventually slip into a stage in which they learn that rules are in fact not so sacred. They come about as a result of consent in other ways. And they don't look at them so rigidly, and they're not so perception-bound when it comes to rules. And this occurs between ages 6 and 12. He defines morality as a system of rules, and the essence of all morality is to be sought for in the respect which the individual acquires for those rules. I think he views society as pretty much rule-bound, and how we look at those rules has much to do with our morality. He poses an interesting question. How does the mind come to respect rules? Where do we get this respect for rules? He notes the following points about the development of respective rules. Through cooperative activity, the child develops an understanding of the purpose and origin of rules. Children through ages 7 or 8 consider themselves humbly submissive to all rules that govern their lives. They are very much adhere to rules. Third, the heteronomous child, while holding a divine respect for rules, does not have adequate understanding or motivation to be consistent in the practice of rules. They may obey them, but they really don't understand everything that's behind the rules that are formulated and handed down. And the fourth item, not until reaching what he calls autonomy, do children really understand why rules exist in our society, and that they actually have a place in making rules. Associated with heteronomy is moral realism. Moral realism for young children is very much a literal interpretation of rules. The rule states a certain thing, you're supposed to obey it. It's a very literal interpretation. Associated with that, of course, is punishment. If rules are broken in the minds of young children, a punishment is in fact expected. It's almost an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of situation. Also associated with it is the size of the violation of the rule. For example, breaking a small pane in one of these windows is not as bad as breaking a picture window. Excuse me, it is worse. It is not as bad as breaking a picture window. Picture windows are bigger, therefore, it's far worse. And the size of the incident or the damage done or something like that should mean that the punishment should be that more severe in the mind of young children. Matter of lying. Young children lie, and it's natural for them to do this. We should not get upset with this, but we ought to be concerned about it if it begins to manifest itself as they grow older. The child cannot distinguish his own private dreams, wishes, and imaginings from what actually exists. They cannot, in a sense he's saying here, determine what is real and what is not real. Lying tends to linger longer than other moral realism issues until about age 10 for a number of reasons. First, lying is natural to the child. He has no felt need for truth. Secondly, adults may punish lying more severely than other faults because they think it is important to impress on the child the heinousness of lying. It's probably the worst thing a kid could do is lie. Third, the child cannot understand the fault in lying until he is in a society of mutual cooperation and experiences the need for truth. Okay? On development of justice, Piaget, in essence, here believes that children develop a sense of justice by the way they interact with others. It's not what you tell them about justice, but it's how they relate to their peers and to adults, that they eventually develop a sense of what is just in terms of behavior. We, however, associate punishment with justice. Between ages of 8 and 12, when cooperation and mutual respect are starting to develop in a young person, there is a shift in the type of punishment that exists. Some children are able to understand that punishment should, in essence, fit the crime. Piaget has found that some acceptable punishments and those that are involved in reciprocity in Piaget's opinion is, the punishment allows the individual to get back into good graces with those who punish, be it parent, teacher, what have you. But reciprocity means that the punishment is going to allow the individual to get back into good grace. Now, he lists acceptable punishments as determined by older children as being acceptable. And I think they're interesting. Exclusion, suffering the immediate material consequence, depriving of the thing misused, doing to the offender exactly what he has done, restitutive punishment, paying for the thing, whether it was a window or what have you. And censure only, with no punishment, concerned only to make the transgressor realize he has broken the bond of solidarity that existed. Now, I want to stop here with Piaget before going on to Kohlberg, but I wanted to allow you to have some kind of background information, even though it's sketchy, to give you some idea of Piaget's views. His thoughts on moral growth and development are not as well developed as Kohlberg's. And Kohlberg has gotten his thrust to move into this area based upon Piaget's initial discoveries relative to interviewing many children. Do you have any comments or questions at this point?
One thing I didn't quite understand, when he talks about lying, that lying tends to linger longer, which is one of the reasons that adults may punish it more severely. I don't quite see how that follows. It's quite clear on the map of mind.
Okay, and why it lasts so long?
Well, it seems to give a lot of reasons for lying lingering longer, but adults punish it more severely. Mm-hmm. Surely that would probably cause the reverse.
No, it in fact promotes it. Because you are in essence then conditioning a child by your reaction to the incidents of lying to in fact create that relationship. You're paying attention to the individual when they're lying. And secondly, if you keep them at that position where you dwell on lying and you're trying always to determine whether or not they're telling the truth, you are in fact, in Kohlberg's views, keeping them at a lower level in moral development. Okay.
Do Piaget or Kohlberg, are either of them particularly Christian? Does Christianity enter their views at all? Moralism apart from plain moralism?
I think it's probably apart from both of them, more so for Kohlberg, even though he admits that religious organizations and other organizations do have the opportunity to develop moral growth and development in children. But I don't think that, if anything, I would suspect Kohlberg is a Jewish background.
So it would be the Judeo-Christian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is it true that Piaget did a lot of his initial research with his own children?
Oh, yes. He had three children, and most of his research was done on his own three, which caused immediate suspect. You know, how can you be objective doing research with three people when they're your own? But the interesting thing is that all those who have tried to disprove his theories have found out that he is pretty much on target. It's hard to fault him empirically through research. He is pretty much on target.
How did Piaget's children turn out?
Quite well, I guess. He's not a very domineering or authoritarian type. He's a very gentle, loving person. Yes?
Does he use, is punishment the only behavior modification he uses?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No.
No physical punishment.
No.
He used no physical punishment, just these other things that he listed here.
He dwells on punishment because that's a common reaction that adults have, rather than using alternative ways of bringing about more desirable behavior. Okay, ready to move to Colbert. Yes.
I was going to ask a question about this number four, doing to the offender exactly what he has done. The thing that I have particularly in mind is this business of children and biking. Mm. And I remember very distinctly as a little child, a child bit me. And I went crying to Mama, of course. And then the other Mama found out what her child had done. She came and took the little child's arm and bit it. She said, "Now you won't do that again, will you? Because you know it hurts." Well, I thought about that a long time. And then not so long ago, I read something about it. It said, this is not the way to deal with biting, because if you bite back, then right away somebody, one of the children, assumes that biting is accepted as adult behavior, mm-hmm. because an adult did it.
Yes.
And that made more sense to me than the mother biting the child.
I don't know, my mother bit me and I never bit her.
Yeah. I think the worst punishment I ever had as a child was I clobbered my sister over the head with something, and then my mother made me go to her and say I was sorry and kiss her. I'd rather have been hurt right then, because she was depriving me of seeing a little kitty in a hole in the barn, her foundation. But at least I didn't bite her. And she didn't clobber me back. Wasn't sure the kissing was the right thing either,
mm-hmm.
but that was at that time.
If I could stay on this issue of lying for a minute before switching to Colbert. At commencement this spring at Wittenberg, the commencement address, which wasn't an address at all when it was finally delivered, was given by James Akins, who is the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And he lectured the graduates. He lectured everybody. It was not a typical commencement address. But he addressed the group, all of us, on lying. That was his theme. And he was talking about lying and deceit in the U.S. government, about the practices that have occurred. And I brought the clipping with me, which has excerpts from his speech. He has some very interesting things to say about how our government promotes lying, which is a shift from previous foreign policy. And he is upset about that. He has since resigned from the government as a result of what he doesn't like is acceptable diplomatic policy.
I was thinking that it might make a difference what culture you're in when you're talking about lying. And what lying really means, it would mean something different in one culture than another, wouldn't it? You just spoke about the ambassador, and maybe think of some friends who had spent quite a long time in Iran working on a water project over there. And the whole approach to lying over there is so different from the approach here, that what sounded like lying among the people is just the accepted behavior there, because they said what they thought you wanted to hear, that was being nice. And that for Americans, it's just extremely difficult because you never know what's really happening. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I would think that trying to study lying among children in a different culture would be completely...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you couldn't disregard that. But I think there are certain characteristics about lying that hold true for all people as they grow from childhood to adulthood. It's true. Let's switch to Colbert stages. It's true for Colbert stages. He has done worldwide research on this since he published his dissertation in 1958 when he graduated from the University of Chicago. Regardless of class, culture, caste, religious group, people go through these stages as he has them outlined, regardless of where you go in the world. The only thing he has found out that very few people are able to function at stage 5 and 6. That is the most difficult level.
In our whole advertising scheme today, almost everything is fabricated and a lie, isn't it? We accept it as a truth, the same with political promises.
Yeah.
Do we get to a judgmental state so we evaluate ourselves on the basis of our own experience, whether it's truth or a lie, at least to our intuitive values?
Yeah, I think we do. I think we have to arrive at some judgment when we look at who's telling the truth, the Watergate thing.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, does he define what a lie is? You know, what is not telling the truth? Right? So many times now it's what you leave unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to know the question in order to get the right answer. So is it an outright falsehood about something that happened, or just not revealing all that occurred around it?
I think it could be those, and it could be lying also on young children has to do with their inability to perceive the truth. They can do something, and you can see them do it, and you can ask them, did you do that? And they will say, no, I didn't do it. But it's a mental thing that they can't do that would allow them to say, yes, I'm guilty, I did that.
At what age is this, do you
know? This would be with preschoolers up until probably about age 6.
They have real. About 75 for golfers, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's true. For fishermen.
I was just thinking of a situation with Tom Kite where the ball moved ever so slightly when he was addressing it to putt and he called a penalty on himself. Now, I would never dream of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I watched another golfer on TV where he put his club behind the ball and it moved a little bit twice. According to the rules of golf, there should have been a two-stroke penalty. It was Bean, and he went on to win the tournament. Mm-hmm. He should have lost it. Mm-hmm. So how in the world do you arrive at that point for that which is hard and fast, which is discernible, becomes a rule to be followed versus some idiosyncrasy of the game?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is there such a thing as a compulsive liar? Is it a disease?
I think, yes, you can condition people to behave that way.
I know, well, that's a problem with alcoholism. They're just from their first trees.
I work with junior high people, and I'm sure they are compulsive liars. And you say, did you do that? No!
Well, I think, too, we can set up situations where a child has no choice but to lie mm-hmm. in order to save face.
Sure.
Or
if there's no need for the truth at that
yeah,
point
what
in time,
difference does it make?
So I can get away with it, see. Chuck?
You know, it's really fun to go on this excursus about lying, but what Piaget is telling us, and it's not really a contradiction of anything we believe or don't believe in terms of lies, but he's saying, and I think it's very important for us to pay attention to that, that in the moral development of somebody, there is a level whereby many moral decisions are, on the basis of a higher level, immoral. That to understand that your child lies naturally, whether it's an inability to perceive or to make associations or to even know the truth, to know that he lies and not to think in terms of him as being some demonically possessed individual is really a way to help you understand mm-hmm. and allow that child to develop. Actually, his lying is an indication of his development.
Mm-hmm.
And until guys like Piaget and Kolder walk along, you know, I think we really did sort of treat our kids as being possessed
mm-hmm.
rather than allowing them to sort of develop naturally.
Well, we acted very judgmentally and in a rather harsh fashion toward that. When we could see a situation develop and follow it through and then have them report that they were not implicated in any way, you know, just almost make your hair stand up, and then we would react to that.
And the problem very often is not always the child who lies, but the reaction of the parents that does something that doesn't permit the development of that child. Four times. I wish I'd have known some of this 18 years ago when I was raising a 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem, just like he said, that when you're raising your first child and he's going through something, you think, oh my gosh. And this is the way he is, and he's permanently damaged. And if you know that these things are coming up, then you can help him to grow out of them rather than to probably make the matters worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole secret is to have get your first children you practice on,
mm-hmm.
and then your second children, then you'll know. Your second.
Yeah, but what
do you do? Do you? I mean, that's just imaginary. But if you had a family to practice on, you'd know the second one.
Yeah, if you could practice on somebody else's kids, that'd be great.
You're not responsible in the sense of it.
Yeah.
Another thing that stuck out my mind, too, is that we all lie and
sure.
we all cheat.
Sure.
And we all continue to do so no matter what we say about it.
Mm-hmm. And remember that when you get into covert, because when you do that, you revert to a different level of making moral decisions.
Okay, some information on Kohlberg as a person. He's currently on the faculty at Harvard. His stages of development are receiving rather severe challenge. In fact, he has had to rethink some of the stages, particularly the area around stage four, because there's some indication now, based upon further research, that there might be a sub-stage to number four, as it's outlined. He graduated from the University of Chicago in 1958. He, too, was a brilliant individual. He finished his undergraduate work in 2 years at the University of Chicago. However, it took him 9 years to finish his Ph.D. It took him that long because he got wrapped up in this whole issue about moral reasoning and moral growth. And it took him quite a while to begin to put something together, which ultimately ended up in his dissertation, which are the stages of growth and development. Now, he indicates to us that we proceed through these stages as he has them outlined here. You don't skip stages. You go through from 1, 2, 3, etc. We tend to function, or like to function, at a stage slightly higher than where we are. It's a little more, what you would say, enticing to want to deal with something that's slightly above where we normally deal mentally. He also has approximations here with the stages, and which at what point in time do we begin to progress through these. He has, at the pre-conventional level, approximately 0 to 9 years old, we would participate in these two stages in growth and development. He has done research on prisoners, those who have been incarcerated. And where do you think he finds most of these people in terms of their moral growth and development? At what level?
0 to 9.
They're pre-conventional, but are they 1 or 2, you think? Stage one is basically concern for oneself, out of a punishment obedience orientation. Stage two is satisfying one's own needs. You take care of number one and you're number one. Where do you think they are? They're stage two. He finds that most prisoners are stage two people, and they don't go beyond stage two. They have never progressed in terms of moral growth beyond stage two. And that, I think, says something. He would believe that the reason they're stage two people is the way they have been treated by adults in society more than any other experience.
In or out of prison?
That's prior to prison. That they have gotten to be very egocentric, selfish, they look out for number one because that's the way they were treated by adults. And they never had the experience to progress morally to higher levels. That's interesting.
That implies, though, that we could train them to another level.
Yes. Good. But I don't think most prison reform programs even begin to deal with that. We don't. He has found that most of us function daily at stage four, which is concern for order in society. Most of us are there. Now, he indicates that teenagers up to about age 15 should begin to get to that point. He's doing research right now with cluster groups in the high schools in the Cambridge and Boston area, where he is trying with these inner city kids to have them wrestle with moral issues, to get them to be more aware of moral issues and to grow in a moral reasoning capability is meeting some success at this point, but nothing I would say that would be overwhelmingly significant statistically. You're seeing some progress, but these kids are from tough backgrounds, where the environment is probably pulling them in the other direction once they leave that school experience. But the school experience is one in which they cooperatively have to work together. It's a very democratic atmosphere that he's trying to construct in these classes and have them involved in decision making. They wrestle with issues that have direct implications for them. And is meeting some success, research-wise, that would be supported.
Is it the normal run of children, or are the children of intellectual parents?
These are not. They're probably, you would classify them as socially and economically disadvantaged children.
Do you think they can grasp as well?
It's probably harder for them because they're in an environment in which there's not a great deal of intellectual stimulation.
Would it be true that they would be developing probably pretty much according to these stages within their culture, that in that inner city culture there would be a law and order unto its own?
Yes.
And a society that needs to be protected and be concerned about it. And the switch from that kind of culture to a broader culture is the difficulty.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Their development would be verifiable within experience.
Right.
Trying to get out of that experience.
The great solidarity that exists in gangs, it's very hard to break that up because they're extremely loyal to one another. And there is a group, a miniature society there, in a sense. And it's hard then to break them out of that, as you indicate, into the larger society. They very much are group bound to the morality of the group.
And the group is number one.
Yes.
The group is number one and everybody else.
You, in a sense, lose your individuality, in a sense, and the group takes priority. Of course, they're at the age also where peers are very dominant in their life, more so than adults, and so they get their support more from their peers than their adults anyway.
At what stage then, like what we call white collar crime, for instance, take wealthy suburbs where mainly white children are involved in a lot of vandalism, a lot of break-ins, a lot of burglary, but have come to the sophisticated knowledge that their parents can get them off from any penalty or law. What would that be?
Well, it wouldn't be 5 or 6. I mean, they're below, I would say probably they're still at 3 and 4. And a lot of it's just done, in a sense, for kicks and see what will happen.
But how does that differ then from the kind of thing just previously?
Well,
that's peer pressure too. Isn't that just the same principle? Yeah, the peers are so dominant then. But there is not, you will not find in suburban areas a strong a group solidarity that you find in inner city gangs. I mean, they're not as prone to violence, for one thing. And also, I think the suburban type groups probably can, in fact, take a look at what they're doing. They aren't amoral, as many inner city groups are. They show no compassion for what they for their victims, willingly dispose of people for a quarter. They have not been brought up in a situation in which concern for others is any real part of their life. And it's rip off anybody you can, because you still got to watch out for yourself. Nobody else is going to do it.
This gang mentality can carry off into adulthood too, then into cults. the Jim Jones affair down in South America with adults who align themselves with a strong leader and whatever the leader says. Is
mm-hmm. Obedience to authority. You don't have to think much on your own about what is morally correct.
Getting back to the difference between the lower economic scale and the upper economic scale, where one is so-called frames. We live in an area that's primarily suburban, and the economic values have remained the same. We have more people, but the frames are becoming a little more severe as far as damage and personal damage. Would that be because the lower economic group is now climbing up a little bit? Is that what you...
I don't know necessarily.
Or is the higher economic group just becoming less moral?
I don't know. That raises the larger issues. What is occurring within the larger society that would lead us to believe that there is a decadence in our morality?
Yeah, that's what I feel.
That we are.
Variables like the television influence or the media.
Yeah. Isn't that a commonly held view, though, that morals are poorer now than they were mm-hmm. 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Mm-hmm. That we have, in fact, lost ground. That's a general feeling. I don't know that I'm willing to buy it at this point. Thank you.
How does a person progress from one stage to the other? You started out by saying that teaching morals doesn't have any effect.
I don't know that I want to convey that information. What I want to convey, if you try it by moral precept, well, you hand down do's and don'ts. The research would not support that that's going to be effective. But what you will find to be supportive of improving moral reasoning and greater moral growth is by participation, cooperation, active involvement, where it's a growing, living thing. But you're not handing out edicts about don't do this, don't do that, and there's severe punishment if you do, etc.
One of the buzzwords in education now is holistic teaching. And this is getting to this where the child, the whole child walks into the classroom, not just the brain. You know, you involve that child in decisions in the classroom as much as possible. Mm-hmm. If they have a stake in it, then they can see, yeah, it works. You know, I do have some say in this in my future.
And don't disregard the fact or ignore the fact that children still learn through imitation. That's very powerful. And if you structure situations in which you wrestle with moral dilemmas as a rather common experience in a family or in a school setting, a church setting, that presents to the individual who is still growing, the opportunity to see how that's carried out, to get the thinking that goes behind decisions, to arrive at consensus, to reach judgments on issues. Now, how do we get people to progress? That was one of your questions. Kohlberg indicates that what we should do is to create moral dilemmas for people to wrestle with. We're not at a loss to find them. We've got more than we want to deal with, maybe. But to actually get people to participate in moral dilemmas where people can express themselves and they begin to look at various sides and positions where they can understand why some other group would look this way on an issue. So that they really have to wrestle with the problem. That's how you bring about improved moral growth. Not that you're always going to agree on what's correct in a given situation, because some situations are so complex that you may talk through these things forever and never arrive at any consensus that the group accepts. It's still such a hot issue that no one will really you can't arrive at a point of consensus on the issue.
A lot of church groups oppose this too, actively. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to hand down precepts than it is to allow allow people to arrive at their own sense of moral right.
Going back to the Boy Scout situation 20, 30 years ago, this was a combination of both, wasn't it? Both setting down some precepts, but also a learning experience to reinforce them?
I've never was a scout, so I can't speak for that. But I wonder if the talk in scouting differed from the actual practice.
A
couple years ago, didn't we have a national scandal? Weren't the executive officers in the National Boy Scout organization ripping off the organization with money? The
Girl Scouts did last year, no?
That's true just by every area of life, isn't it?
Well, certainly the people in the LCA headquarters in New York wouldn't be that way.
Maybe every year.
Chuck? They could get away with it.
Huh?
You have another session on this? Are you?
Yeah.
What's the other session?
I want to deal, after you have given some chance to look at this and rethink some of these stages and so forth, to come back tomorrow. We are running out of time here. And deal with some moral dilemmas. Well, that's one thing. Another one, to look at the issue of, is there such a thing as Christian morality? Does that sound fair enough for everybody? It's a little topic we could deal with. But I think it's helpful, Chuck, to have some knowledge about Kohlberg, and then we can look at some moral dilemmas and see where we are.
What he says is we behave because we're going to get caught or we may get hurt. That's the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. And then we obey the speed limit because the law says that we're getting to a general community. And then we obey the speed limit because we want to save lives or something like that.
Yeah, we have a greater concern for society in general.
Yeah. Broader than just ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What stage are you in now? You're going down the list here?
Yeah, you know, starting at the bottom and then
one,
all the way up.
One,
why
two, three.
Do we drive 55 miles an hour?
Somebody's
got a
CB.
Yeah, we can
get caught.
We have to have a
punch.
That's
a pretty good. Yeah, we can find people here will drive 55 or less for a variety of reasons.
And I think we can state the reasons and you can tell us what level of thinking we're at.
Right? Well, I suppose you say it's economical.
Yeah.
That's probably higher level, right? Mm-hmm. 5 or 6?
Mm-hmm.
Economical would be taking care of number one,
huh? Economical for you?
Or
yeah, right.
Saves
gas.
Saving energy.
That puts it at a different level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How about the bumper sticker somebody saw in Texas that says, drive 95 and freeze a Yankee?
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions on what you would like to do tomorrow as a continuation of this session? Does that sound?
I think that question is, there such a thing as Christian morality?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how we move from stage to stage.
Okay.
If you could also maybe address the issue that you brought up earlier about, is our morality getting worse?
Oh.
Mentally, how can the national church leadership encourage congregations to address these issues and not close the door on them because it isn't enough?
Mm-hmm.
Especially too, what Howard said too, make it kind of a cross-generational thing too, because you know, those of us who are younger have a different, you know, I can learn a lot, I'm sure, from what people thinking morals have gone down the last 60, 70 years. I'd be very interested to hear that.
Well, would you like me to bring back about 5 or 6 moral dilemmas tomorrow?
Yeah.
And then,
I appreciate this very much.
Okay. Well, I hope that gives you some idea of what Kohlberg and Piaget have to say on the issues. you may want to talk about the stages some more if you want further clarification of what they are.
Any other going for the genes or the tendencies or anything like that?
No.
You're implying that all this is learned behavior. And anything that's learned, we can either unlearn or relearn.
Well, not all of it's learned, because some of it's natural. It's a natural occurring thing as we grow. We go from one stage to the next. But the what's interesting is that we can progress beyond where we are if we make an effort to do so. But if we
do that just by thinking abstract thoughts, or
not
watching society, how they're making decisions, how do we progress?
Well, I think one thing is to be actively involved in issues that are beyond where we normally are, a stage above. Okay? Let me give you an example. Where would you put Martin Luther King? What stage? Why, Chuck?
Universal good beyond his own interests. Because I already read a book that that's where he was
classified. All right.
Now that was an honest
answer. Yeah, that's right.
Not that before else.
Yes.
What if he did it only for his own good?
Well.
What if he was only concerned about himself and it just splashed off that way?
Oh, I well, does anybody act out of anything of self-interest? Really, basically? You
well,
have to have a modicum of self-interest to be
sure, you have to have that to start with.
But even for somebody like that, you can't classify him in six all the time.
No, that's right.
A lot of times in what he was doing, that he was at a lower level, even late in his life.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about Kohlberg is that we can decide to go back a stage and react that way. I'm going to go to stage two and respond here. That's why I'm going to be on that issue.
Is that likely to happen if working at the level where we are does not produce the results that we want?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, for example, to take the King example there, the really interesting thing about nonviolence was how to maintain that as a kind of a moral stance in the environment where that was not producing the desired result.
Is there any correlation here? I doubt Kohlberg would have made it, but do you see any correlation between his three stages and the old transactional analysis model, parent, adult, child, where you participate at different stages of different situations in different ways? Is he roughly standing at something like that?
No, I don't believe so. It's an interesting kind of comparison, but it's not the same.
Yeah. But don't you think maybe we are at all stages? In a sense, in different situations.
I think we can resort to previous stages, but I don't think we do that.
But then we
with
have to
consistency.
Have a judgment that says this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wouldn't it rather be called an expansion instead of a linear progression? More like concentric circles, where the possibility of moral development would build on the last stage before.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really digress to it. An earlier stage, you're just kind of delving into what's always been in there, and then but you have an opportunity for something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he would say based upon his research that if you're basically a stage four person, you really can't regress to stage three and abandon stage four and function at stage three level. You can't regress that way. You can flip back, however, and give a stage three response to something, but that doesn't mean you participate at stage three all the time. There's a girl back here. Way back. Let me ask this. Oh, excuse me.
You had said something earlier about this five and six that most can't function at that. Mm-hmm. Could you expand that?
Okay, we can't. Okay, the evidence is that we aren't there yet. We're not there because we don't do enough in the way of preparing people to grow that way. If we did more, we would see more people get up to that point. Let me give you some findings at this point about how many people make it.
Could you first just I've been trying to look through here and see what 5 and 6 are, and I haven't been able to read fast enough to get a real picture in my mind of it. Could you kind of just dumb it down a little bit?
All right. Let's see. Stage 5 is a social contract legalistic orientation, which is basically the whole society determines what is right. There are no legal absolutes. Changes are made where the greatest good will be obtained by the greatest number of people. We need to account simultaneously for all situational aspects, motivation, general principles, things of that nature. But we're talking now about what will benefit the greatest number of people, what's the best thing for society. These things can change because there are no legal absolutes. Stage 6 is universal ethical principles, ideas of rightness that apply to all peoples, focus upon ethical principles such as justice, equality, dignity, things of that nature.
Never compare.
Huh?
Never compare.
Principles are higher than laws and may be unwritten, moral, and universal. Now, let me ask this question. Where do you put Carter's appeal for human rights worldwide? Where is he with that issue?
It's a stage 6 issue.
Yes, it is.
Whether it's being promoted for stage 6 reasons is another question.
But if it's a stage 6 idea, most of us cannot comprehend a stage 6 idea if we're not functioning at that level. So it's doomed to failure. And maybe, you know, if they realize that you've got all these really nifty ideas and they sound really good because we would like to be functioning there, but since we can't, the person who puts them out knew that that wasn't going to work, and the ulterior motives might be what it's going to deteriorate to.
Yeah, but if Martin Luther King was operating on a level 6 too, and a lot of things he put out contained some amount of understanding, and also something good came out of it. So you can't just say it.
No, I'm not putting it down, I'm just putting out that possibility.
But is what you're suggesting that maybe with a challenge to stage 6, even though people may not rise to stage 6, they may rise from 3 to 4?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that King did, and some of these, you know, his mind popped to my head the minute we got this thing, because he made people wrestle with the moral dilemma, which you talk about as a way of promoting our growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether we made it, whether we agreed or not, we had to wrestle with the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The same as the world hunger issue and some very important issues now. We may not operate in that realm all the time, but merely having to wrestle with the issue helps us grow. And having our children wrestle with us helps them grow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wait a
minute. I've read that Martin Luther King and Jack Kennedy read Faith into Their Lives. And if that's true, then if it's not what I morally believe, I lose respect.
Well.
Martin Luther, they say, swore heavily. Like his cup of ale. What are you going to do about that? You can't expect any human being to be non-human. A person can have areas in their life that are fallible, and we can't expect them to be absolutely safe. Even, we keep hearing the word never, and it's difficult, and all these kind of things in terms of moral development and actual functioning at those levels. Well, it seems to me that we say that because living at a level six stage is full of responsibility and personal choice and decision and risk. And most people would prefer a security blanket of rules and to not have to take personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm. It isn't the fact that a level 6 person has marital problems or something helps me stay at 4.
By saying never.
No, George.
But
also, we're operating in these different areas. We have the public self, and they operate one way, the hidden self, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then also to remember that today, at all times, we all have a backup style that comes to the fore under stress. And under stress, we tend to revert to infantile behavior, which says something about a day and an age like our, where we're living under so much stress. Mm-hmm. A lot of undesirable behavior comes to the fore at times like that. We do things we normally wouldn't do, but that's our backup style under stress and crisis.
He has, Piaget Kohlberg has studied the same group that he used in his dissertation study. This is a longitudinal study that's been going on since prior to 1958. In 1976, none of those people in that group had reached stage six yet. They haven't made it. So few get there. But that doesn't mean you can't strive to do it, to get there.
How come then it says approximately 16 years old?
That's when individuals should be capable of dealing with those kinds of issues. But I don't think we in fact don't deal with those issues with people in high school and in college, much less. We don't. We deal with other kinds of issues. We don't get them involved in issues that are really involving such things as ethical universal principles.